Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is the second episode of the Wrestling Culture Podcast. This is Dave Musgrave. I should be joined shortly by Dylan Hales. Just waiting for him to call in, and hopefully he does. Otherwise, there will be some awkward moments of me not knowing whether or not to continue with the podcast. Today, we intend to talk about Terry Funk and his merits as possibly the greatest professional wrestler of all time. This is an opinion that is held by Dylan and that I border on myself, and we're going to try and flesh out the merits of that. Hello, Dylan.
Hello. How are you?
Good, and how are you doing today?
I am wonderful, hoping not to get poured on. I'm stationed outside, so if we hear some rain in the background, that's what's going on. But I'm ready to talk up my my hero.
You're going to talk about me?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's really what it's all about here. You're doing an outdoor podcast today yourself?
That's right.
Yeah, unlike WWE, you are not afraid of rain.
No.
So, yeah, again, I'm joined by Dylan Hales now. My name is Dave Musgrave, and this is the second episode of the Wrestling Culture Podcast, in which we are going to talk about one Mr. Terry Funk and his career, which has spanned from the 60s until current day, and whether or not he is the greatest of all time. Dylan, this is definitely an opinion that's held by you. I think, you know, there's at least close contenders in your mind, but you feel that Terry is. Why don't you talk a little bit about what makes you think that Terry Funk is the greatest wrestler of all time?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, I should say that I'm at least partially partial to him for reasons that are outside of the typical analysis that smarty pants fans like us would normally engage in. My dad grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, when he was a kid, which was at least loosely part of the Amarillo territory, which of course was the territory run by Dory Funk Sr. and later Dory and Terry. That was my dad's wrestling, and I sort of inherited a fondness for the Funks from my father. Having said that, I don't think, my dad was a big fan of Ricky Romero too, and I wouldn't necessarily talk him up as the greatest of all time. For years and years, I've sort of had an internal debate in my mind about, you know, who I would consider the clear-cut greatest of all time, or if there even was one. And for the longest time, the two names that, you know, I've kind of hung my hat on were either Terry Funk or Ric Flair.
Ric Flair would be the answer for most people, I would say.
Absolutely. I think that's shifting a little bit, unfortunately, mainly because of, you know, the view, I think, correct view, that Flair's hung on for far too long and maybe tarnished his legacy. And I think now we're to a point where there's a whole generation of fans that sort of only know this sad, bumbling old guy.
Yeah.
and know a legend of him having good matches. And maybe you've seen some of them, but they have no clue just how important and great he was at during his peak.
And all the fans who spent years blowing tons of money on wrestling DVDs and live event tickets are very critical of Ric Flair's financial decisions. So.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. it's kind of amusing, but Ric Flair's star of the Cleveland show, I might add. But with Terry Funk, I think he's an interesting case because I think he sort of exemplifies what makes pro wrestling so interesting and so great, both to smart fans and non-smart fans, even casual fans, which is he's one of the rare case of a guy who it always leaves the customer, if you will, wanting more. Funk is a rare instance of a guy who I don't think ever really wore out his welcome anywhere, and if anything, maybe. Yeah, he still has. You know, I mean, there's still, you know, you still see his name pop up on shows, and you at least feel like he's going to give you 100% effort. Obviously, his knees are shot physically. There's very little he can do compared to during his peak period. But I mean, even as recently as this year, at the PWG event when they did the Legends Battle Royal, you know, him and Piper brawling around the arena was said to have stolen the show. And watching the show, I felt that it was certainly one of the better things on a show that was loaded with some of the top, you know, wrestling talent in the world. So that to me is really the definitive case for Terry Funk, on top of the matches, that he's a unique guy because of the fact that he never wore out his welcome in a business where everybody wears out their welcome. I mean, he may be like the one guy who you can say he never stayed around any place too long. I mean, I've used this term before, and I admit that it's stolen from someone else, but Terry Funk is like the ultimate loser-leaves-town wrestler. He's there long enough to make an impression, to make you mark out, to make you kind of lose your shit at whatever angle or promo or match he has. It's so great because everywhere he goes, he has them. And then he's gone before you know it. And like I said, you're left wanting more. You never feel like you were cheated or that you didn't get what you paid for. I think even with Flair, because of, you know, hanging on around too long and sort of making a mockery of himself at various points over the last really 10, maybe even 15 years, that feeling even with Flair, I don't know that you can say anymore. You know, there are other contenders for sure, and I'm sure we'll get to some of those later, but Funk is I think that simple fact, combined with the great matches, the fact that he was in all over the place, spanning his entire career, really solidifies him to me as the greatest of all time, because he's somebody I've never gotten sick of.
And for me, Ric Flair is one of my favorites of all time. And he should be for any wrestling fan, no matter how much they want to tear apart stuff now.
Absolutely.
There's nothing bad to say about the guy as a performer, as a professional wrestler. But Terry Funk just has done, I think, more and more places. He's had more versatility than Flair, and honestly, more than anybody. I would say, certainly on that larger scale. His book was one of my favorites, and his talk about promos and interviews is really good. I actually have it open in front of me here, and he talks about how he puts his real life into interviews, and people pick up on the emotion. And the promo that he talks about the most was one from about 2004 against Jerry Lawler. So he's even putting his heart and soul into stuff now. And just talking about the psychology of interviews and how to get the fans into the arena, Ric Flair is known for great promos. But I think a lot of his great promos are a lot more on the charismatic side, whereas I think Terry Funk's might be more on the drawing side, like making you want to see someone take him on.
I think for Flair, the promos were about the mystique. You know, yeah. And by the way,
the character,
to his credit. I think really he would have been foolish to do anything else, because one of the things about Flair is that his entire gimmick was predicated on the fact that everybody had to believe he could be beaten by every single guy that was a territorial star. He had to build up his image so then they can send him the pre-tapes or people watching TBS or whatever. When he comes to town, he has this image as this major star, and then he goes there and takes, you know, 15 back body drops and 12 gorilla presses and is about to lose and somehow wins or cheats or DQ or whatever. So it's a different situation with Flair. I would actually say Flair is a better promo than Funk, to be honest with you. But I think the big difference is not only the stylistic difference that you noted, but also the fact, like you said, about versatility. Versatility in delivery as an overall character, I think, is one area where Terry Funk is almost untouched. Terry Funk is, in my view, it's no worse than one of the five best baby faces of all time, if not the best baby face of all time. And
with amazing work in all Japan.
That's right, which is particularly astounding because there were not baby face Gajin. I mean, they didn't exist. He, like, to be a baby face and an American in Japan at the time, especially one on that level, was, so far as I know, just didn't happen.
He transformed the gimmick, basically. He transformed the role within wrestling of the Gajin in Japan.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it's really unparalleled. To people who haven't seen Terry Funk at his babyface prime in All Japan, you really should go seek it out, because it is almost impossible to comprehend just how over he was as a babyface as an American during that time period when that had been totally, really unbroached territory. And
I mean, the one especially is his quote-unquote retirement match with Dory against Stan Hansen and Terry Gordy. Like, I don't think you could ever see anyone who's more of a babyface than he is in that match.
Absolutely.
But it's not just that. I mean, on the All Japan set, watching the match he had with Nick Bockwinkel, he was over huge, and he wasn't lots of other. He and Dory against Abby and the Sheik, they were huge in those matches.
Yeah, I actually think those are some of the most underrated matches of all time, because the premise behind the match is basically that Terry Funk is a victim of an attempted murder from the beginning of the bell until the end, and he's able to sell it and time his comebacks, and the delivery of his comebacks is every bit as good as what you would expect from all the other great baby faces, whether it be Ricky Morton, Ricky Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, if that's your preference. It doesn't matter. Funk is right there with all those guys in terms of being able to lay out that type of match. And yet at the same time, when most people think of Terry Funk, they don't think of babyface Terry Funk. They think of either crazed old man Terry Funk or vicious heel Terry Funk. Or there's a multitude of even within his crazy old man gimmick, there were sort of nuances depending on the scenario or the context.
Yeah, and go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, well, to add to his babyface curriculum vitae, I guess we will say, is his work in Amarillo, which there isn't footage of, which is unfortunate. But the numbers are there. Just the history is there of he and Dory being baby faces there and carrying the territory for a couple decades. I mean, the 60s through the 70s into the early 80s. And then what there is footage of and is awesome is his baby face run in ECW.
Yes. Yeah. I really feel like Funk and ECW, it's easy to sort of dismiss it as obviously past his physical prime, which nobody would contest. But
no.
I think it's easy to dismiss it just in general as something that appealed within this niche environment, which is partially true. But let's be honest, Funk pretty much created that niche environment. I mean, Heyman's a carny. That's a fair assessment. Who in the wrestling business is? But Heyman, anybody will tell you, ECW almost certainly would not have gotten off the ground and been as successful as it was if it wasn't Funk.
No, and he was the ultimate legend on the roster.
Yeah.
It's very hard to top it. And people are going to say, you know, ECW wasn't profitable. Who cares? It was awesome. And Terry Funk was an awesome part of it. His barely legal was he was amazing on that. Just charisma wise, work wise, everything.
Yeah, I think Funk in '97 actually. I mean, that's one of the really amazing things about him. I mean, we were talking about the Abby and Sheik matches, but those matches occurred in '77, and he was a great babyface in '77 and '79 are the two most famous. But you know, that was 20 years prior to that run in ECW '97, and then he comes and '97 he's a babyface again. This time is sort of the old man, you know, looking for one last run on top or whatever. And he's just as good in a totally different environment. I mean, yes, it's similar from the perspective that, again, there's a lot of violence, more violence than the average promotion at the time, just like with the Sheik and Abby matches in All Japan. But it's the context is different. I mean, one of the things I discovered in going through and helping recently to compile a big ECW set was that Funk in '97, in general, had far more good matches than people realize. I mean, the assumption is, well, he had the barely legal show, and
that was the visible one.
Yeah, and then the Born to Be Wired match with Sabu, which is obviously a great and totally insane violent match. But you know, he had a very good match with Tommy Rich from the ECW Arena. He had a good match with Chris Candido. He had a couple of good matches with Brian Lee, who nobody would recognize as a good worker. He had a good match with Axel Rotten, and he actually had a couple of matches from house shows versus Shane Douglas and Sabu on during a one-week period that were both, frankly, brilliant matches. I mean, as good as any match in the United States in 1997.
Did you mention Candido?
Yes. You could run down pretty much any match he showed up in 1997 he was good at. You know, and I think that's, you know, again, it's easy to say, well, that wasn't his prime, and that, you know, that's sort of you know, he didn't have a huge volume of stuff, but that's sort of always been the rule with Terry Funk. You know, he's like I said, he's around for a little while, and then he goes somewhere else.
And don't judge it how it compares to his other eras. Judge it how it compares to you know, anything else. Judge it on its own merits, I guess, as being a very strong run.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, and you know, the thing about, because there's so many of those, there's so many of those runs. You know, you've got your All Japan run that we can document that really starts in the mid 70s and then runs through to the mid 80s. You know, you've got the stuff in Puerto Rico, which is really entertaining and almost a totally different side of them. You've got the WCW, the famed WCW run in 89, which made me a fan for life. I mean, Flair Funk feud made me a wrestling fan for life. That's what did it.
That's actually what I'd like to jump ahead to, is that we've talked about Terry Funk as the greatest babyface of all time. That might be one of the best heel runs of all time as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what's
Against Flair, I might add.
And I think what's undersold in all that is, of course, people remember the two Flair matches, and they're great matches, and people should remember them. But I don't know how many people remember the Steamboat match from the Clash of the Champions, which was also a great match. And I don't know how many people remember the what I consider maybe the best 5-minute match of all time, which sort of is an odd thing.
You're going to mention
the Eddie Guerrero match, where Terry Funk went out of his way to get Eddie Guerrero a job. By the way, that's why he gave him so much offense in the match. I mean, it's a great TV match. And really, all of his squash matches or semi-squash matches that year, whatever you want to call them, versus guys like Scott Hall, Ricky Santana, the poor Myrtle Beach, South Carolina jobber Cougar Jay, who Funk almost killed. I mean, all those matches were entertaining. I mean, he was a guy, during that whole run, you can't point to any weak showing from him. None. And they all fit within his character.
And then you add in stuff. I don't remember if the Thunderdome cage match was very good, but just the Funk and Muda against Flair and Sting was a great feud as well.
Yeah, I mean, I conceptually, I think the feud, that match was far better than it was in practice. That's maybe the one match you could point to as disappointing during that run. But I think that's less an indictment of Funk than it is just a
they tried to make it too complicated. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and yeah, 89, another great run. 94, I mean, literally, you could almost break down year by year. But 94 is actually another really, really, really great Terry Funk run that is almost never talked about. That was a period where he was working indies, WCW, ECW, Smoky Mountain,
Japan,
everywhere, literally almost simultaneously. And what's unique about Funk is, you know, he would have a great match, you know, versus Sabu on, you know, like an ACW card or one of these independent groups, and then turn around a couple weeks later and he'd be wrestling in Smoky Mountain as Jim Cornette's hired hand, and then turn a couple days later and he's wrestling, you know, Tully Blanchard at Slamboree or something, and it was literally like the last stand of the journeyman type role in wrestling was Funk's run in 94. And he was great across the board everywhere he went that year. I think actually one of the more underrated performances in any match is Terry Funk in War Games 94, which in and of itself is an underrated match, but just an awesome heel performance from him in that match. So you've got multiple years where you can look at and say, okay, but at this point Terry Funk should be washed up. Nope, another great year. And even now, or in the last decade, you know, I've watched matches with him versus Lawler, you know, from the 2000s that were really good. That, you know, if they were, you know, on a pay-per-view, people would be raving about them. But you know, they're not. So.
and his. I really liked his match teaming with Dreamer against Foley and Edge.
Oh yeah, that was really good. That was really, and honestly, you could really tell he was physically limited in that match. But I actually think in a way that speaks
that
even
almost
more
added to it. Yeah,
exactly, because I think it actually added to the storyline of the match and made the match better. But yeah, I you know, you can let, it's real easy to let the case based on versatility, based on what I talked about him being sort of a unique figure and that he never got old or stale or tired.
He was doing USWA in 94 too. I'm looking here.
Oh yeah, I mean he was all over 94.
Everywhere.
You know, I mean, I mean, everywhere, literally. It was like I said, the last run of the journeyman. I mean, and you can, I mean, look, you anywhere you look for a Terry Funk match during really any period, there's a good chance you're going to find a quality match. I mean, one of my favorite discoveries in the last few years was a match Funk had with Tony St. Clair from Europe that in 1993, which I believe December of 93, which I'd never heard about before. Tony St. Clair, who I think is a fairly good hand, but not known as a spectacular worker, I thought it was absolutely excellent. Up there with anything I've seen from anywhere in the world in 1993.
I haven't seen that.
Well, very few people have. You know, I mean, that's one of the things. Funk as the journeyman during that period, which really, 91 through 94, that's pretty much what he was. And maybe even 90 through 94. And
actually,
tons
it would
of
be
good stuff.
90 from when he left the NWA, and he had that, that indie match on the island with Stan Hansen.
Oh, yeah, that's a great match, too.
I didn't know if there was footage of it.
Well, he had the match where they got the match where they brawl in the river. Is that what you're talking about?
Yep.
Oh yeah, there absolutely is footage of it. Great match. Not as good as the All Japan stuff, but again, you know, and I mean that's kind of another interesting thing about Funk, because if you look at some of the other all time great wrestlers, Jumbo Tsuruta, Ric Flair, Stan Hansen, Jerry Lawler. A lot of them have, not necessarily their very best match, but some of their absolute best matches with Terry Funk. And again, Funk isn't a guy who stayed around in any promotion for a huge length of time. So the fact that he has these sort of career-level matches with some of the best, in my view, wrestlers who ever lived is yet another thing that I think is kind of in his favor.
So I am just looking at some of the match history now, too. In October 89, he was doing host shows against Brian Pillman. That must have been awesome.
Oh, I don't doubt it. Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure he also worked Eddie Gilbert in some house shows in 89 that never surfaced. There's a cornucopia of stuff out there from Terry Funk. I mean, it's sort of the gift that keeps on giving in a way, because every time you think you've seen like his last possible really good performance that could be unearthed, something else emerges and it turns out to be pretty good. You know, I mean, I think that, again, speaks to why I would consider him the greatest of all time. Not that there aren't other viable candidates, but he certainly has a unique quality to him that I don't think anybody else can quite match.
And speaking of unique qualities, I mean, his NWA world title reign was a real shift in the way that title worked. And although it was brief, I mean, that was by his choice. He balked out of the title based on his book and based on the fact that everybody did in those days because the schedule was too much. But he went from being the guy who would, you know, wrestle for an hour and have the draw where he, you know, made it look like the guy was going to win at the end of 60 minutes. And, you know, like I actually know of one match against Leo Burke, of course, where he got himself disqualified at 56 minutes. And that's basically what he would do, is he'd do a wild brawling style and lose control and get disqualified because in order to save his title. But I think without it becoming a cheap and finish.
Yeah, his NWA run in some ways is the most infuriating thing ever because we have virtually none of it. I mean, one of the amazing things about Terry Funk, and another person who I think is sort of a much better wrestler maybe than some people give him credit for, and that's Nick Bockwinkel, is we don't really have them, arguably very little of them anyway, at their athletic peak. I mean, we have some clips of Funk versus Jack Briscoe, some clips of Funk versus Chavo Guerrero in L.A., which I can only imagine had to have been insanely great. I mean, there's no way it wasn't. But we don't have a composite sketch of this person from their absolute peak, which to me is it's almost astounding that, you know, and it's possible that he wasn't as good then as he would be a few years later, where we do have some stuff that's entirely feasible. But either way, it's amazing that there's this strong of a case for a guy who's, you know, at the height of his relevance as a figure, there's no footage. or very little footage at all. I mean, with the, you know, even with Bockwinkel, who is similar in that we don't have as much of his, you know, athletic peak on tape as we do, nearly as much as we do of his arguably post-prime physically. What you know, with Bockwinkel, we do have him as a relevant figure because he was AWA champion. He was sort of the anchor of the promotion to one degree or another. You know, so we do have that. We can see what he did in that role. We don't even know what Funk, what Terry Funk was capable of, you know, unless you were around and alive at the time. We just, there's no way of knowing.
Written word, but.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, and that's almost, you know, I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing. You know, it's kind of infuriating to somebody like me who just loves watching good wrestling, but it also is sort of novel to know that this guy, we may not, as great as he was, we may not have even seen him at his best.
Yeah. So, yeah, he won the NWA World title from Jack Briscoe on December 10th, 1975 in Miami Beach, Florida. Then the next day he was off to the Central States area. I'm just going to run through his title right here, if that's okay
sure.
with you. He was in the Central States area defending against Jerry Oates, Ed Wiskowski, and Jerry Oates again. Off to Florida against Rocky Johnson, Jack Briscoe, Cyclone Negro twice. Then off to Georgia, Jack Briscoe back to Florida, Dusty Rhodes, the Spoiler, Mr. Wrestling 2, and Dick Slater. So that wraps up 1975. One thing I do know is he wrestled Wrestling 2 a lot, so that must have been crazy considering how over Wrestling 2 was in Georgia.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. He then went up against Abdullah, off to St. Louis for Pat O'Connor, Toronto against Carpentier, Thunderbolt Patterson in Florida, as well as Billy Robinson, Dusty Rhodes, Stan Stasiak in Toronto, Pat O'Connor in Texas, Jose Lothario in Texas. That would have been great.
Wow.
Pat O'Connor down there again. Otto Von Heller, not sure who that is. Off to Texas, still in Texas, he's against Peter Maivia, Super Destroyer, probably Don Jardine, I would assume.
Yeah.
Jose Lothario, Greg Valentine, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, I mean, God.
Gene Kaniski, a couple matches in St. Louis. Off to Carolinas against Wahoo, Paul Jones. Jose Lothario again, Harley Race, Jack Briscoe, Dusty Rhodes. You know, I don't know if I can go through every one of these matches.
I mean,
but,
but that's like a who's who is kind of the point, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, we have
know.
Billy Robinson, Mike Graham, Abdullah the Butcher, Chavo Guerrero. Instead of reading everyone, every single match, I'll just go through who pops up. We have Andre in Miami, Jack Briscoe again, Fritz Von Erich, the Stomper in Calgary. That would have been crazy.
Yeah, I envision a bloodbath.
Yeah, Wahoo, Dick the Bruiser, that was in St. Louis. Chavo again, Gene Kaniski, Big John Quinn. I don't know if you know much about him, but he was supposed to be pretty good. He was a Canadian guy. Dennis Stamp, July 30th, 1976.
Amarillo?
Yeah,
Stamp was, you know, pushed there at various points. You know, like he wasn't always a preliminary guy, which is, you know, kind of, that's, I think, after Beyond the Mat or whatever, that's sort of like the image people have of him, that he was always this preliminary guy.
Yeah, he had two matches against Funk.
Yeah, yeah, he was pushed in Amarillo for a while. Yeah, absolutely was.
Two matches against the Assassin. He also had Jimmy Snuka, Jerry Lawler, Wrestling 2, Tank Patton, Don Fargo, Bob Backlund.
God.
Ken Patera. And I'm just about done.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's pretty much a who's who, and virtually none of that is on tape.
Yeah, Bob Brown, Slaughter, Dennis Stamp again, Greg Goliath, Ivan Putski. And, yeah, that takes us through to losing the title to Harley Race in February 6, 1977.
Which was so. In Toronto, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah,
and there's actual footage of that match. So.
Yes. Yeah. There's. I don't remember if it's complete though. Whatever the case may be, that's. Yeah. I mean, that's a lot. It's a laundry list right there. But the point is, he wrestled everybody during that period, and his reputation even then was that he was great. You know, you can almost. God, stuff like the Chavo stuff, especially to me. It's almost mortifying that we can't watch it. in full. But I mean, definitely.
That speaks for a lot in 1970s anyways, but especially, that match.
Yeah. Especially because if you look at his match with Jumbo Tsuruta in 76, it is a great match. And I watched it last night, actually. I'm not as high on Jumbo as others, but, there are a lot of people who think he is the greatest wrestler of all time, or at least in that discussion. And, Funk being able to do that with Tsuruta still being, relatively young, and have a match of that quality is pretty amazing. And a totally different match from what most people would think of with a Terry Funk match at that, too.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that he did that really has to be considered in his run is during Terry Funk Jr.'s reign from 69 to, I guess it was, 71? No, 72.
72, I think.
73, actually, sorry. I apologize. Basically, a lot of the times, opponents who would be working their way up to Dory would have Terry as their stepping stone.
Yeah.
And, like, whether or not they could get a match with him, how they were doing a match with him, in storyline at least, would build up towards Dory. So.
Terry was a gatekeeper. Yeah.
Which, it's cool to think of the guys that managed to get a match out of that. I wonder if there were as many guys that got turned away at the gates, so to speak, storyline-wise. That would have been some interesting storytelling, too.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, as far as numbers go, I mean, he was a draw in All Japan. To my knowledge, a very good draw as NWA World Champion. He and Dory were both draws in Texas, and Dory Funk Jr. is someone I'm a fan of, but I think most people, just in general, would probably acknowledge Terry as being better all around.
Yeah, I think that goes without saying. I I'm not a big fan of Dory Senior or Junior, rather. But even if I were, I think
it's no insult to say that Terry's better.
Yes, exactly. And definitely more of a modern pro wrestling figure. For better or for worse, I mean, maybe if you prefer sort of the way Dory worked, that's fine. But, Terry is definitely a more modern pro wrestling figure. And very cutting edge. Always consistently, kind of ahead of his time. I really think the ECW run, helping establish ECW, it's not a credential in and of itself that means a whole lot, but it definitely has value that he was sort of the linchpin when they were first getting things kicked off that gave them value and made them allowed them to survive and get over the hump.
He came off so well and beyond the mat as well, as far as just being awesome. Heyman's promo backstage talking about how everyone needed to thank him and how he was unselfish in selfish times. Heyman, of course, is, the cult leader, but it was just great.
We haven't even talked about the Memphis stuff with Lawler, which is the empty arena match, which is one of the more famous matches in wrestling history, especially from a territory that was not Crockett or the WWF.
One of the most famous moments.
Absolutely. Very, very few non-Crockett or WWF matches that are on that level in terms of fame and what they're known about historically. And the match, the no DQ match between those two in 81 is just an absolutely awesome match. Just a great match.
Is that on the Memphis set?
It is on the Memphis set, and it is as good a Jerry Lawler match as you'll see. I mean, it's probably not as good as the best Lawler Dundee matches, but it's certainly not much worse. It is right there with the best of Lawler versus Dundee and the best of Lawler versus Dutch. And again, Lawler and Dundee and Lawler versus Dutch were wrestling each other all the time, whereas Funk was just in for a short period of time. So that sort of speaks to my point about him having these career matches with these guys who he wasn't necessarily matched up with, year after year. Lots of times it takes a while to develop that chemistry, you know, or sort of to develop the backstory you need to get something over. With Funk, it really didn't take that long. You know, that last outlaw gimmick or whatever you want to call it always seemed to work right away. There was no delay. The Lawler stuff is should not go without being mentioned specifically. It's not to be casual. And the fact that they've been able to milk it to the point where if I don't know what Lawler's status is after last Monday, but it's at least possible they're going to have yet another match here in a few days. You know, and they've had matches on and off over the years, all through the 2000s that were, frankly, all of them were very good. I mean, I've never seen a bad Jerry Lawler versus Terry Funk match, and it all goes back to that feud that started in 81.
I believe he worked in Germany as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. I believe that's where the St. Clair match was. You know, and Funk's got the Fit Finley match from Europe that's widely regarded, and I mean, he's been everywhere. Definitely been everywhere. Nobody has quite this mixture of things. I mean, the thing about Funk, too, is it's not just versatility and character. I mean, we mentioned the Jumbo match. The Jumbo match is a lot different than the matches versus Sheik and Abby. And those matches are a lot different than, say, the Funk Brothers versus the Mil Máscaras and Dos Caras. And those matches are, you know, not the same as Funk versus Eddie Guerrero in 1980. I mean, he's very good at catering himself to the needs or demands of a crowd and sort of altering his style or throwing little things in a little bit here and there to make himself fit more with whatever he's supposed to be playing.
Interestingly enough, it was actually 90 to 93 that he was working Germany. So, as you said.
Yeah, again, the journeyman.
Yep. And apparently he may have worked early in his career as Dr. Knows-It-All. Cage matches, that was a good site, and it lists that as one of his early personas, that and the Texan. So... I got to see if I can find any matches of him working as Dr. Knows-It-All.
I wonder what that gimmick even entailed. But anyway,
I really hope it was actually being a know-it-all and skips backstage. That would be great. Yeah. did you know he had his first match against Sputnik Monroe?
I did not know that.
Yeah. So.
I did not know that. That is a actually kind of surprising. You know, wow. What year was that? What year was his first match?
I just have a thing in front of me that says he defeated Sputnik Monroe in his hometown of Amarillo on his professional debut. I can get that for you in a minute here.
I have no recollection of when he debuted. I was just curious.
Yeah, I have his book in front of me too, so I can look through. I mean, my introduction to him, too, is actually, I think I've told you before, basically, my introduction to wrestling, there was some, you know, the Maritimes was on, the TV show was on, I'd catch it once in a while, but wasn't really into it, and then Rockin' Wrestling started, Hulk Hogan's Rockin' Wrestling, and we got the TV station out of Detroit in the Maritimes, and we would watch Rockin' Wrestling, and right after was Superstars, and the first show of it I ever watched, he wrestled, I think he actually wrestled SD Jones, and that might have even been when Dory first appeared. I just remember him being on, my brother saying, I have no idea who this guy is, and then, you know, I thought he was pretty cool. I enjoyed watching him through that year. Then I saw him, then he disappeared. Then over the next couple of years, I saw him in Over the Top and Roadhouse, and then all of a sudden he was in the NWA, which was great.
Yeah, it's funny because his WWF run, I think, is easy to forget about. And, you know, he was not really presented as a top guy. He did work Hogan several times, and those matches were good matches. But he was in no way presented as a serious threat. I mean, he certainly wasn't King Kong Bundy or Paul Orndorff or one of those guys that got a real money feud with Hogan. But there's one of my actual all-time favorite Terry Funk, which is covering a lot of ground because he's probably in, like, I'd say, like, a third of my top 50 favorite matches ever are Terry Funk matches. But one of my very favorite, not to say it's one of the best, but one of my very favorite is a Terry Funk versus Lanny Poffo match from, I believe, 85. And Funk...
And for me, I started at the beginning of 86. So, yeah.
So the match is... First of all, it is quite good. It's actually sort of similar to the Eddie Guerrero match in that Funk gives Lanny a lot, and they sort of go back and forth, and they actually do some high spots for the era that were not common. But Funk's reaction, both to the ring announcer and the ring boy taking his jacket, and then when he goes into the ring and Lanny, like, cuts a flip or does, like, a forward roll or something – and the look on Terry Funk's face is awesome. Like, it looks like he is absolutely infuriated, which, of course, is funny since this is the guy who incorporated moonsaults into his repertoire when he was, like, 50.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, he looks absolutely like he's literally infuriated and appalled that this guy is in the ring doing gymnastic spots. And then he proceeds to beat the hell out of Lanny Poffo.
And again, he just made so much out of everything.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Everything was a big deal.
Absolutely. And you know, I like I said, there are other candidates, and, you know, maybe we could run down a list of other guys, but I...
That's exactly what I was going to say. But
I mean, there's very few. And, I'll let you toss out some names. You can toss out some names.
Okay, so just quickly, the major things in Terry's favor. Work rate, he's got it on anybody's psychology. He's got it on pretty much anybody. Longevity... importance, and okay, so as far as how good you were, he was as good as anybody. How successful you were, he was successful in anybody as anybody in his way. And how important you were, well, he's definitely influenced a lot of people. So obviously the other candidates, Ric Flair is always the first one that will come up. So Ric Flair had longevity, great match quality, great personality. Very successful, very good, very important. Again, I think the edge that Funk has over him is probably in the versatility.
Yeah. I think the really big difference between Funk and Flair, and I've wavered back and forth between these two over the years, is versatility and also the fact that Terry Funk has never worn out his welcome. I mean, you can make the case that we should only really be comparing peaks to peaks, and that's a fair point, I suppose.
I
think it's a fair point from the perspective that you don't. That most of the time, when you talk about things that are great, you're evaluating the aspects of them that are great, and not the aspects of them that are mediocre. I think, you know, the problem though is, with Funk, there's so much good post-prime that to ignore all of that seems ridiculous. You know, like, you can't just ignore his entire ECW run and pretend it didn't happen because it was technically after he was prime. It seems insane that you would ignore Funk from 94, or Funk in 93, or Funk in 97, or even his better matches from the last decade. I just don't see how you could do that, whereas... with Flair, I think the only way he has a clear advantage over Funk is if you do ignore, essentially, certainly the last 10 years, with the exception, I would say, maybe of that weird period where he was essentially working an American Onita gimmick and doing garbage matches, which I thought were pretty entertaining.
Funk, you mean? Yeah.
Flair. I mean, when he was doing the Edge ladder match.
Oh, yes,
and the Foley match with the barbed wire and the Big Show match. I mean, I thought that was actually the best Flair had been in, you know, years. And I think another thing that does hurt Flair, and I think this is, you know, goes without question, is that Flair, if you definitely, there were times where watching a Flair match, you felt like he could have had a better match with his opponent, but he wanted to get in his stuff and didn't necessarily trust the other guy to bring anything to the table. I never really felt that way for a Terry Funk match, even when it was obvious Funk was doing something similar. It always seemed like he gave the other guys something. I mean, he had no reason to give Eddie Guerrero anything in 1989.
No, he was just, but yeah. And I'm a big fan of Old Man Flair. I really like his tag team with Batista. But I think Old Man Funk is better than Old Man Flair.
Yeah.
And I think pre-World Champion Funk is probably better than pre-World Champion Flair as well. Now, Flair's NWA World title run was longer, but you could really argue that it was, as far as the traditional NWA World title run, 89 is basically when that ended.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think also the thing you have to take into account with Flair is the fact that you can compile a list of negatives almost in and of itself makes him, I don't want to say clearly worse than Funk, but I'd put them at a disadvantage, because with Funk there are very
few negatives.
A
slight notch behind.
Yeah, I mean, the only real negative you can have, you could throw at Terry Funk, is that he wasn't an ace of a promotion for a very long time aside from Amarillo. But that was sort of the point of Terry Funk, is that he was this, like I said, this journeyman, this roving guy that was everywhere and did everything.
And it was in an era where that was what you did.
Absolutely. I think it would be wrong. To me, it's wrong to hold that against a guy when that's sort of the whole point of his gimmick. To me, that would be like holding it against Abdul the Butcher that he wasn't a good mat worker. You know, like, that's not why people go to see Abdul the Butcher. It would be ridiculous. If you went to, you know, you might kind of chuckle if Abdul the Butcher was applying a surfboard, but that's not why you went to see him. And I would
like to see that, though.
I would like to see it, too, but you get...
I would actually like to see Abdul the Butcher on a surfboard.
That could, you know what? That could be a topic for the next show.
I'd also like to see him come to the ring to Eye of the Tiger, as he did in Montreal.
God, I got to see that.
Okay, so, I mean, as far as Funk goes, too, as far as not being the ace of a promotion, except, you know, possibly ECW,
yeah.
And FMW.
And Amarillo, which we cannot overlook.
Yeah, but it's almost like the knock that goes against the most modern guys that they didn't work enough in enough territories. It's like, well, then you worked in many territories and you can't now. Then you really were affected negatively by staying in one territory too long, and you became the Sheik. I mean, the only guy who managed to do it during that era probably were guys in Memphis.
Yeah, I was just about to say, one of the few guys who I would consider a serious guy, along with Flair, is Jerry Lawler. Because I do think Lawler has a lot of the same advantages. I think Lawler's a better promo than Funk, which is, again, not a knock on Funk, but Lawler's a tremendous promo. I think Lawler has that versatility that Funk has in terms of being able to be a great face and a great heel. Lawler has the longevity. I mean, he's still having very good matches even now at 62 years old. The only thing to me that works against Lawler in a comparison is not so much that he was primarily a Memphis guy and that's where he, you know, I actually consider that a plus, the fact that he was able to do so much in one place and didn't have to go anywhere else.
There's not enough other pluses on top of that.
Yes, I think the problem is he's not quite. Doesn't quite have the overall spectrum that Terry Funk has.
Because,
you know,
Lawler could be an argument for best of all time, too.
Absolutely. I mean, Lawler is on my short list. I mean, if you were forcing me to make a list today, Lawler would be in my top five. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But I think he does suffer a little because he doesn't quite have those extra intangibles that Terry Funk has. I mean, and that may seem like a cop-out, but I don't really think it is. I think there's something to be said for the things Lawler... You know, Lawler post-prime has had some good matches, but I don't know that post-prime Lawler has ever done anything like Funk's ECW run, you know? Or even his WCW run in 94, you know? Clearly a great wrestler, and I would not really argue with anybody who said he was the best of all time. Same thing with Flair. I might argue with him, but I wouldn't condemn that choice as insane. You know, I think it definitely is a choice with merit. But I think he does lack the intangibles that Funk has.
Now, some people that you know especially, would probably list this guy as being up there for the best of all time, and that's Fujiwara.
You know, I feel like Fujiwara is one of the on a very short list of people who I could maybe be convinced that that was true. But there's a lot of Fujiwara I haven't seen.
Yeah.
And it, the problem is also the overall context is tough because Japan is so different to directly compare to the United States. I'm not saying it can't be done, but I'm saying it is a little bit difficult because, you know, yeah, Fujiwara's, you know, had the great run in New Japan. PWFG stuff is great.
PWFG, yeah.
But it's not like he was jet-setting around.
UWF as well. But
yes, yeah, obviously. Yeah. But it's not like he was jet-setting around the way Funk was, you know. And
no.
You know, not that that in and of itself is an obvious plus, but it does make it harder to compare the two, I think. You know, you almost have to go exclusively on match quality when you're comparing Japan to U.S. And while I think it is at least possible that Fujiwara has more great matches than Funk, I'm not sure I believe it, but it's possible. I definitely don't think he has more good matches than Funk. And I certainly don't think he has as much variance in terms of what he brings to the table as Funk, which is not a knock on Fujiwara because he's pretty much the master of a style. And I think it's wrong to criticize people and he didn't stay exclusively within that style. I mean, some of his best stuff is sort of on the fringes of that shoot style. Some of his stuff in the 80s in New Japan. But I can't quite rate Fujiwara above Funk. As long as we're on the subject of Japan, I think
just to give my two cents on Fujiwara as
sure,
well.
Sure, yes. Oh,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah. You know, watched most of the New Japan set. I still have to finish it off. Haven't watched any PWFG and have seen some UWF stuff with him. Honestly, if I was even going to come close to putting him in the realm of greatest of all time, it would be because other people tell me that he's that good. I enjoyed his stuff, but it's more as a, this is a guy who's underappreciated. Go back and look how interesting he is and how awesome he is.
I think the strengths of Fujiwara, I think the two areas where he really has, well, really maybe the three areas where he has strength is he's a great defensive wrestler. I think that's sort of his claim to fame.
Greatest selling, I believe.
Yeah, but I think the other two areas where he's really incredible are his facial expressions and mannerisms and his facial selling are out of this world great, frankly, on another level for maybe anybody ever, including Funk, who's really good at that. I mean, just absolutely tremendous. And I think the other area where he's very strong is, you know, there's something about him. And there's very few wrestlers like this.
He's got a uniqueness.
Yes, who has an innate charisma where he shows up, you immediately feel like the match is a bigger deal, which is almost insane when you consider the fact that he was never the top guy during the height of that New Japan stuff. But when it's just by virtue of showing up or tagging into a gauntlet, showing up for a gauntlet or tagging in during an elimination or a tag match, it almost instantaneously feels like the match is more important. And there's very few guys in history who you can say that about. And I think that's one of the things about Fujiwara that you cannot underestimate. It's why, even though Riki Choshu is not necessarily a guy who I think is the very top tier of best workers ever, I think he is a really underrated wrestler. Because Choshu is the same thing. You know, that sort of business is about to pick up, whatever thing that they both sort of have when they show up. There's very few guys who have that. So I think that's one of the big things in Fujiwara's favor.
Yeah, and again, it's not that I dislike Fujiwara. It's just, you know, I like to watch him. I find him interesting. He's definitely a guy that I love the Segun Nakaida stuff where they dig up old stuff on him and appreciate it. He's just not in the realm of greatest of all time. He's not Flair or Funk, and probably not Lawler for me either.
Yeah, I would have all three of those guys ahead of Fujiwara if you were telling me right now, if you forced me to pick. No doubt about it. My top Japan guy is kind of a toss-up. I'm very torn between either Fujinami or Tenryu. You know, those are kind of, and I could go either way on those. I think Tenryu is a very interesting comparison to Funk because they both have these really long, drawn-out careers. And I think, in some ways, Tenryu is also similar to Funk because whereas Flair in the United States and obviously Kawada, Misawa, and even Jumbo in Japan have these reputations of having all these great matches, both Tenryu and Funk don't necessarily have the reputation of having as many great matches. But both of them have these sprawling careers of consistency and quality that go on for decades.
Yeah, and Tenryu's stuff in the 90s is somewhat under the radar in terms of his matches themselves being remembered.
I think the war stuff is drastically underrated. I have nowhere near gone through as much of that as I should.
No,
but
that's the thing. It's like comparing, you know, Funk's 90 to 94 stuff, and, you know, just because it was under the radar doesn't mean it wasn't great. And I haven't seen his war stuff.
The snippets of war I've seen are tremendous, and I have no problem saying that the best of that stuff is right there with the best of the All Japan stuff in the same period. I'm sure most people would think that was a crazy statement, but having seen the bits and pieces I've seen, I have absolutely no problem saying that. I mean, it's again, Tenryu has that Fujiwara-like quality where the matches just seem like a bigger deal. Very unique charisma in the ring. Very stiff. His grumpy gimmick is obviously comes across very well. I think on the Death Driver Best of the 80s All Japan set, he comes across very well as a guy who was, you know, maybe not good as early as Jumbo was. I think you could make a case that Jumbo was good, really good before him.
I've actually read Meltzer wrote that he was kind of over pushed until 1984, where he became at which time he became an all time classic.
That may be a fair characterization, because I think Tenryu was clearly, by the time 88 or 87 really hit, there's no denying that he was a great wrestler.
Oh.
I mean, at that point, it's not even arguable, I don't think.
No,
and,
no.
And really, I think even before then, you could make the case. But by 87...
I love that Mil Máscaras match.
Oh, I love Tenryu, period. I mean, he is great, and he's, you know, definitely a guy that I think is in the discussion with Funk, and he's also similar to Funk because he sort of has that journeyman quality later in his career where he was bouncing around and just sort of going where the money was or where the matchups were. I mean, even as recently as last year, he has a match with Sayama that was quite good. I mean, when you consider the fact that Tenryu's knees are – I mean, we think Terry Funk's knees are shot. You know, it really was a great, great performance for both guys, and I'm not even a big Sayama fan, but – yeah, Tenryu's a guy that I could see in the discussion.
And his stuff from 2000, I guess, basically after the Noah Japan split, like when he became Triple Crown champion, that was a great run.
His absolutely.
So
he was
possibly the best in the world at that point.
Yeah, I would almost, you know, I would say almost certainly the best in the world at that point. And, you know, Tenryu... he's a guy that I think I will reserve final judgment on him. For the time, I would definitely still have Funk ahead of him. But I would reserve final judgment on him with the, you know, until I watch more of the 90s war. You know, he's one of the very few guys, maybe one of two or three guys that I could see a case for being better than Funk. There's not very many that I could be persuaded on. Tenryu is one of them. Fujinami, I don't think I could be persuaded on being better than Funk, but I think Fujinami's, you know, run from the late 70s, maybe even really the mid 70s, through up until 89 is just absolutely great. I mean,
yeah,
I think he was the best Japanese wrestler in the world in the 80s.
Why don't you discuss Fujinami while I pretend I'm not putting the phone down and taking a quick break?
Yeah.
Shoot.
Well, with Fujinami, if you go back to his best, you know, go back to the 70s, when he's, you know, his junior run started, he's got really great matches against people like the Guerreros, and it's a stripped down style. It's a style that may not entirely resonate with fans that are newer, But it's hardly devoid of high spots. It's hardly devoid of action. It's hardly devoid of interesting work. It's not, you know, a match that you, or matches that you would criticize for stalling or meaningless garbage. And then when you segue into the 80s, I mean, in 1980, he had what I regard as probably the best match in the world that year versus Dynamite Kid. He was maintained his status as a great, great junior, and then sort of transitioned into, you know, the 1A to Inoki's 1 as the top guy in the heavyweight division.
Excellent points. Right with
you know, great during the gauntlets, great during the elimination matches, great, really great against almost anybody. I mean, you know, there are really good Fujinami matches with everybody from Ron Starr to Maeda. There are not many people who could say that. I think what hurts Fujinami is his 90s stuff, while I think it is nowhere near as bad as some people would say, is definitely a major step down. And,
yeah, it just wasn't as good as he was.
Yeah, and while he has had good stuff in the last 10 years, I think probably more good matches than people remember, including a match versus Nishimura in 2006 that I thought was great, there's very few and far between, arguably even fewer than Funk, despite the fact that Funk has probably worked even a little bit of a lesser schedule than him over the last decade. So, you know, Fujinami, I think, is a guy that could maybe match peaks and maybe even to some degree match Funk in terms of versatility of opponents, having a good matchup with his broad. But I don't think he can match him in versatility. I don't think he can match him in longevity. I don't think he can even necessarily match him in uniqueness and that innate extra quality. And that's not a knock on Fujinami, because I really think he is extremely unheralded. I would take him over Jumbo Tsuruta in a heartbeat. And that's not a knock on Jumbo. That's just because I think Fujinami is better during their respective peaks.
One thing that I guess Fujinami and Flair and, Fujinami and Flair particularly with this point have over someone like Funk is, I don't know, you could say that's because of his versatility, but it's hard to narrow down who Funk's all-time opponent would be. I mean, Flair, Steamboat, Fujinami, Choshu, you know, these are the classic rivalries, and Funk was just everywhere.
Yeah, I think that's true. Funk has classic rivalries, but they're not ingrained, and they're not, you know, yeah, I see what you mean. It's not.
He doesn't have the classic series of matches, except possibly with Flair that I can think of there being footage of.
Well, I mean, the Hansen stuff from All Japan is pretty great, but it doesn't quite fit to me with what you're saying. I understand what you mean. I mean, the Lawler stuff is pretty great, but it's spanning over multiple decades, and they're just milking a feud that's kind of famous for all it's worth, which is good for them, but it's not really the same thing.
Maybe Foley would actually be his person now. That
it's possible. I actually think one of the interesting things about Funk, too, not to totally divert this away from guys to compare him to, but, and I've said this to you last night, and I've said this to other people in the last week, I think Funk is almost, it's almost crazy to say this, because normally you would think this would be a disqualifier, but it is at least possible that Funk was never the best wrestler in the world in any given year, and yet I have no problem saying he was the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
Like, that seems like it would be a knock against him.
But your top two or three on 30 different years.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of astounding, because if you go back, I mean, I think you could probably make the best cases, you know, for the late 70s years. But even then, there are other guys who would at least be in the discussion. I mean, I feel like, you know, in 79, for example, Buddy Rose would be in the discussion, at least for me, and Fujinami maybe. So there are, even in years that don't seem like there are a lot of candidates, there are guys that are right there with him. But again, it just doesn't. It doesn't matter. Maybe it should, but it doesn't matter, because he's always in the discussion. And any time he shows up, it's always something you want to see, and it's always good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, that's – he doesn't have disappointing matches. I mean, he really doesn't have this – he's maybe the only guy where I really struggle to think of any Funk match that I've seen that I would characterize as disappointing. You know, every other guy we've mentioned so far, I can think of matches that I thought were disappointing. With Terry Funk, I can't. I, off the top of my head, at least, I can't think of a single one. And maybe
what
that's
about his
series
WCW hardcore title matches with Screaming Norman?
Well, you know what's funny? You know what's funny? As somebody who's actually watched those in the last couple of years on my buddy Will's big Terry Funk set, while they're not good matches by any stretch,
they are good for what they are, I'm sure.
They're entertaining enough where you kind of are able to put aside the fact that they're not any good. You know, like, it's, and that's kind of the, one of the traits that Funk brings, too, is, you know, he may not have a home run match every time, but he's certainly not going to have a boring match.
No.
I guess maybe the only Terry Funk match I've ever seen that even borders on being boring is the Terry Dory Jr. match from All Japan. Like, I don't think I've ever seen any other match that between with Terry Funk in it that even bordered on losing my attention or me thinking it was tedious in some way, shape, or form. And that's another very rare trait. Very few guys you could say that about. But anyway, sorry for the diversion, but I did want to throw that in.
Yeah. Fujinami, for me, great stuff with Choshu. It's hard for me to put either of them above each other because I think they're both just as great. I actually really, really like their match from 1992 from the WCW Super Show, where Choshu beat Fujinami for the IWGP title.
Yeah.
It was kind of my first real pro match. The stuff in the WCW, first WCW show was all pretty good, but this is my first exposure to what a really solid pure Raisu match could be, and I just really like that match. And I was probably underwhelmed by him against Flair, but that was more because I was 16. I think it would probably stand up pretty good. All his New Japan stuff is pretty solid that I've seen. But
yeah,
doesn't have the versatility of Funk or the longevity.
Yeah, I think I pretty much agree with you across the board. I'm definitely, I think, higher maybe on Fujinami than you are, but I, in general, I agree with everything you just said.
Yeah.
I don't have any.
I think he's great. He just doesn't touch Funk.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess as far as the fans go,
in ring, yes, in ring, yes.
I mean, as far as the other candidates go, I guess the All Japan guys, you know, you can kind of dump them in a bucket, which isn't maybe fair, but I think that's kind of how everybody views them. You know,
yeah,
everybody
Jumbo was great, I think. You could say that his 80 to 86 period might have had some disappointing moments, but had my favorite match in the All Japan set, which is against Kerry.
Yes.
Had great match against Flair. His AWA title win and defenses were great. You know, Jumbo was awesome. Just it's hard to put him over Funk for me.
Yeah, I think Jumbo, he definitely played his role effectively. It just happens to be a role I hate. I mean, like, I that's not a knock on him. It's how he was booked, and it was obviously a smart way to book the promotion. I mean, look, it worked. I it's hard to criticize it and say it's wrong. You know, it's like people who criticize Vince for booking Hulk Hogan on top and say he wasn't a good worker, which I don't even necessarily believe to be true. But even if that were true and Hogan was the worst guy ever in the ring, you know, Vince would have been stupid not to push him on top. You know, I mean, Baba would have been stupid not to go with Jumbo as the ace. He was clearly the best suited for it. He clearly knew how to work the style the best. He clearly understood the sort of hierarchical structure that the matches required. I think, you know, all that.
And he introduced the 90s style as well.
Absolutely. And I don't agree with you know, the sort of notorious Dave Meltzer Jumbo was lazy line that's been batted around the internet in circles where I travel for over a decade now.
I don't think Meltzer would say that.
Well, no, that was supposedly a Meltzer line. Jumbo was lazy. That's supposedly a Meltzer line. I forget the origin of it because it's been around for so long.
I think 90 through 92, he would have rated him as one of the top workers, if not the top in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, Jumbo is – I think his characterization was more that Jumbo was lazy in non-big matches. Sort of the standard Bret Hart / Shawn Michaels house show criticism that has gone back and forth over the years.
Mm-hmm.
To me, Jumbo, I would certainly not call him lazy. I think – if anything, his role at times made him so unlikable for me that he's a rare case of a wrestler that I can acknowledge being absolutely great beyond question, but also a guy where if I never saw another one of his matches, I wouldn't care. I mean, like, he's probably the best wrestler that I can say that about. You know,
yeah.
Like, he just...
Not your thing. Maybe.
Well, it's not even so much that it's not my thing. It's just that character does not appeal to me. It I think I feel about Jumbo the way a lot of modern wrestling fans feel about John Cena, that he's just shoved down your throat and you're supposed to just bite into it and take it for what it is, and that's it. Shut up and like it. And you know, maybe that's a sign that he was booked so well that I hate him because he was such an effective ace. I don't know. But hate isn't really the right word. But, yeah, I
you
know,
you don't lose any sleep over this, I hope.
No. But Jumbo, to me, does not have the versatility of Funk, for sure. That's one area where I absolutely do not buy it. I've had this argument with people before who insist that he does. I do not see it. I think Jumbo is not necessarily a one-trick pony. I think that's being too myopic. But I think he had a very narrow way of working. It was a smart way for him to work. I think he probably would have been foolish to work any other way. But I do not consider him – he wasn't as formulaic as Flair, obviously. He wasn't a formulaic wrestler per se. But he had very narrow parameters, I guess would be the way I would describe the way he worked.
I
never felt it before.
I think he really transformed himself well, though, from a fiery babyface kind of guy to bully grizzled vets.
Oh, absolutely.
In the late
80s. Absolutely. There's no question about it. There's absolutely no question that he was excellent in both roles. You're not going to hear that argument from me.
Yeah.
I think
even though it was due to health reasons, his descent was pretty quick. And I don't mean when he passed away. I mean, I believe he was still wrestling up till the late 90s, but it was all opening card stuff. And good reasons or not, that's something that you can't put on Funk.
No, I think Funk's total body is just so lengthy. I mean, we know from video evidence that Funk had very good matches at least as early as 75 and very good matches at least as recently as 2006. I mean, like, that's 30 years, you know. There's not very many people that can say that. You know, I think... Maybe no, but I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe, but there's not very many, period. I mean, I suppose maybe Luthez, you could say that about, who we don't have a lot of his footage from. But there's You know, there's not very many people that you could say that about. Jumbo had a great run. I think you could argue, certainly, that Jumbo had more great matches. And if your metric is entirely who had the most great matches, then I think... Sure, you could argue that Jumbo is better, but to me, even when you're judging strictly in ring, I don't think who had the most great matches is always the most important, because circumstances can often have a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ultimate Warriors had more great matches than Brad Armstrong, but I don't think very many people would say Ultimate Warrior was a better worker than Brad Armstrong.
By no means. And again, to put something else in Funk's belt, another notch in his belt, he also was one of the trainers for Jumbo.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
I believe he talks about that a fair amount in the book. I know I've seen him talk about it before, but yeah. So, and then I guess the other guys, I really feel like you could just dump all the other guys in one bucket. Kawada,
Misawa, Kawada,
and even Kabashi, maybe to a slightly lesser degree. You know,
I can't even, depending on the day, I'll tell you any one of those three was better than the other two. So I can't even decide who's the best of the three. I don't think I can put any of them over Funk.
I mean, my preference has almost always been for Kawada. I can't even entirely explain why that's the case. I like Kabashi the least of the three, although I acknowledge he's a great wrestler. To me, all three of those guys, you know, it's very hard to say. I mean, obviously we know they're great wrestlers, but
yeah.
Imagine if Bret Hart got to wrestle Steve Austin every single night, or not necessarily every night, but nonstop on and off for basically the entirety of his wrestling peak. How many great matches would those two have had?
Exactly.
You can't really criticize them because that's not their fault that they happen to be there with each other. But I think the knock is always, you know, were these guys really that much better than everybody else, or did they just have opportunity that nobody else had afforded them? They made the most of their opportunities. I think all three guys certainly belong, you know, in the pantheon of the very top guys in wrestling history. But it's hard for me to escape from that. It's hard for me to look past that and say, oh, that doesn't matter. You sort of have to adjust for that reality, which is that, you know, the reason they have so many great matches is because they were wrestling each other. That isn't irrelevant. That means something. It's not a knock on them, but it would be nice if we had a bigger body of opponents. And that's not to say they only wrestled each other. I mean, Kawada had, you know, the great match with Gary Albright. Misawa had great matches once he went to Noah.
Among the three of them, I mean, Misawa was basically the ace during the 90s in terms of he had more matches against Kawada and Kobashi than the two probably had against each other and was consistently great with everybody. Kawada probably had the best pre-1990s stuff with Footloose and with Tenryu, and then I would say post-1990s or 2000s, as we shall call them, Kobashi probably had the best run as Noah champ. So they all have notches in their favor.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I just have a hard time. I think with Kawada, you know, the Footloose stuff I like a lot. I think it's really, really good. And I think it's a notch in his favor. But do I think it's something that...
Oh, it's more of part of his career than it is an all-time great run.
Yeah, I think it's... And I think it is not... I mean, that was probably the area, the period when Kawada had, you know, the most different from what we perceive Kawada as.
Yeah.
And with the exception of Hustle.
Pudgy babyface as opposed to cranky old...
Yeah,
dude.
But I think one of the things that's really interesting is, at least to me, especially in 88 and even parts of 89, I thought Fuyuki was clearly the better guy. And maybe Fuyuki just happened to be really, really good. But it's weird to me to think, like, with Terry Funk, there's not really a period where he was involved in an angle and I thought, or a match or whatever, and I thought, boy, that other guy's clearly better than him. With Kawada, that's not to say he was bad, but those are sort of the things I think about when I'm thinking about tiebreakers when comparing these people. You know, and that's something that just kind of stands out to me, is that I clearly thought the other guy in that tag team was better for at least a year, if not 2 years. I don't know.
Yeah, I would put them together.
Well, you're wrong.
I would. What's that?
I said you're wrong.
Oh, okay. It happens.
Declarative statement. You know.
Yeah. But yeah, I just, again, I don't think any of the three have it over Funk. And basically, if Funk had never wrestled again after 1987, he would be in an argument for the greatest of all time. The stuff post that he did, that could almost be an argument for at least Hall of Fame. Possibly greatest of all time. And, you had the two together, and it works out pretty good.
Yeah, it's hard to argue against. I mean, there are some Lucha guys, and I'm not anywhere near Lucha, well enough versed in Lucha to really make a case. I will say Satanico's best stuff is really good. And he's a guy that, I mean, his best stuff is as good as anything I've ever seen from anybody.
I haven't seen enough of it to say.
But it's few and far between. We don't have a big picture. We don't have a total element to look at. And, you know, I mean, El Dandy is another guy who I think is great and extremely versatile, one of the few guys who I think can match funk with in versatility. But, again, it's just not as much.
No, he would almost be like a good comparison to funk as far as, look how great this guy was. He's like a Terry Funk. But it's not like, you would never say, look at Terry Funk, he's almost like El Dandy.
and then Negro Cautious, who I think is actually, he's a guy I could definitely, he's along with Tenru, maybe one of the two guys that I could really be convinced. Because he does have the longevity, he does have the great matches, he does have the versatility. You know, like both in terms of how he works and ability to get matches against a wide variety of opponents in different settings.
And being great when he's old.
Yes, yes. I mean,
his 2009 stuff was arguably he would be up there as one of the best wrestlers in the world that year for sure.
Oh, and last year too. I mean, he hasn't had quite as good a year this year. I don't think he's had quite as many chances. But anytime he's turned up on tape at TMLL, he's been great. And Blue Panther, I would just kind of throw out. I haven't seen enough of Blue Panther's early run to really compare him, but I really like Blue Panther.
Yeah,
he is
really
awfully good. He's somebody that I. But again, Blue Panther was never as big a star as Funk. He does not have the star power that Funk has. So I don't really think you can compare him to being on Funk's level as an overall figure.
And then you have El Hijo del Santo.
Yes, certainly has the star power. Very similar journeyman stuff. But one thing I will say about Santo, and again, I say this as somebody who's a relative lucha novice, although I've probably watched more than a lot of people. Santo is, I think, in some ways more Flair-like in the sense that he's a more formulaic wrestler. I mean, he's got his spots. He's going to hit them in every match. They're beautiful. They're awesome. That's what people come to see. So, of course, he's going to do them. But I don't know that Santo – he does not strike me as nearly as versatile big in the big picture sense as Funk, based on what I've seen. Although he's certainly good in his old age and a huge star.
Well, and something that could be a knock on him and segues into the next kind of category of guys of comparison is, would El Hijo del Santo be nearly as big if not for El Santo? Like, if he had started wrestling as Orange Monkey in the early 80s instead of El Hijo del Santo,
he wouldn't have had
as big a career.
That's probably true, but I guess you could say the same thing about Terry. I mean, if Terry's dad is not the promoter of the territory that he starts in, and, you know, if his brother is an NWA champion, which is really where he got kind of, I think, his first real big break as a main event or at least semi-main event guy, I mean, does Terry ever become Terry Funk? I mean, you would like to think that the really talented guys are going to be, and it's not exactly the same, because, I mean, Santo's God and Dory Funk is Dory Funk. But it's the same in the sense that they both had an advantage that other people didn't. And I think... What does work in Santo's favor is that he is regarded as such a big figure in his own right.
Mm-hmm.
He's not Dustin Rhodes.
No.
And I love Dustin Rhodes.
I love Dustin Rhodes.
He's not a guy where the perception is that there's a clear stark decline from his father. I mean, obviously Santo is the bigger star and the more important figure. I mean, that's beyond question. But his son doesn't feel like he's so far beneath his dad that they're in different universes, even though in some ways they are. He doesn't feel that way.
Well, as far as star power goes, he possibly is. But as far as work rate goes, he's apparently quite better than his dad.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah.
And I think even as far as star power goes, there's no way anybody's ever going to be as good as the first.
No.
You know, there's no way anybody's ever going to mean as much as Ricky Dozen in Japan. Or even as much as people hate to say this, or even as much as Hogan in the United States. I mean, it's
funny because my next point was going to be the other three comparisons of people that I consider very similar, which are El Santo, Ricky Dozen, and Hulk Hogan. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Well, I mean, it's true, though. I mean,
because I know people who are maybe casual fans who will try to say to me that Hulk Hogan is the greatest of all time. And...
Well,
I very much disagree with the idea. And the other thing is, you could say that there's two people that were better at what he did, which is Ricky Dozan and El Santo.
Yeah, I think with Hogan, you know, if you're looking at it as a from the purely business perspective, it's certainly hard to argue against him. Just the way he and there's you know been Chris Zellner has just written or done a big mock-up piece on this over at ProWrestlingOnly.com where he kind of lays out how the WWF expanded under Hogan and how almost amazing it was the way they did it. And how it's indisputable. No, I mean, this argument that, oh, if Vince had, you know, somebody else could have done it. If Vince had Dusty or the Junkyard Dog, Dusty and Junkyard Dog were great draws, you know, and huge stars. They weren't Hulk Hogan. I mean, as much as it pains smart fans to say that, you know, Hulk Hogan was a guy, a very unique guy, and he was clearly the right guy. And I don't think, but, it is very hard, I think, as a if you have any interest in the aesthetics of wrestling,
it's very hard to put Hogan up there.
To put Hogan as the clear, definitive number one. You know, I mean, we don't do these shows or write the things we write or do the research we research or whatever, so that we can you know determine. Who made
the most
money?
Popular of all time.
Yeah, I mean we do them for bigger picture reasons, and I think in the bigger picture, I think Hogan is I think he's underrated in the ring. I've always thought that. I think he's drastically underrated in the ring, but he's clearly several notches below everybody we've talked about. I mean,
I don't know that he'd go in the top 100 for me in ring.
Oh, no, I don't think he's a top 100 guy by any stretch. I mean, I think there's several tiers of guys that you would rate above Hogan in the ring. You know,
saying Hogan is a better in-ring worker than he's given credit for is pretty realistic. Saying he's a great in-ring worker is like calling Ronald Reagan a great president. Very popular, high approval ratings. Bit of a maniac.
That's probably not a totally. Both of them were real Americans.
Both of them very out of touch with reality.
Ronald Reagan, Hogan slammed the 17,000-pound Andre the Giant, and the earth shook. And Ronald Reagan just pointed to the Berlin Wall, and it crumbled. It vaporized. So yeah, they definitely.
Ronald Reagan ended communism. Hulk Hogan ended the territorial era.
They're linear and important historical figures that clearly coincide and go. You know, it's hard to say who meant more to Western civilization. I think it would be tough to appropriately analyze it. But I don't think Hogan is the big picture best of all time.
Sorry, one other comparison too is they both Hogan and Reagan think their movies actually happened. they think that was actual real life documentary footage of their life.
Now, has Hogan ever gone to a Nazi graveyard and memorialized the people? Has Hogan ever done that? Did he ever have a Bitburg? I don't know.
I don't think he has said that he has fallen in the foots of Hunt Schmidt. Okay, far as Hogan v. Funk, I mean, Funk was a more giving wrestler in terms of, he has the reputation as being someone who put others over. And, you know, like, Foley wrote about Funk as, you know, he said Tiger Jeet Singh became famous because of what other people gave him. Funk became famous by giving to other people in terms of putting other people over. And that's something he would have over Hogan. And Funk seems to have a better mind for the business. Hogan has a good mind for his business, what's good for him. But Funk is very good at being analytical about the business from, you know, honestly, I take that from things Meltzer has said about him. I also take it from what J.J. Dillon said about him in his book when he and Dory sold off Amarillo because they sensed that what Cable was going to do to the business. I also base it on Funk's book, too.
Yeah, Funk clearly is a forward-thinking guy. I mean, I think that is obvious, and I think that's one of his biggest strengths, and I think is one of the reasons he's relevant. And I mean, it's not hard, it's not easy to turn, in the, especially in the 90s, to turn a 50-year-old redneck from Texas into a cult figure.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really think about that on the surface, that seems improbable. You know, it really does not seem like something that could have been accomplished very easily. And Funk was able to do that. I think he really knew how he had to market himself and how he had to set himself up within that business, that period then, and within previous periods. And whereas Hogan clearly was super charismatic and a much bigger star and drew more money, Hogan, I think, also, you know, and he had two great runs, because the NWO heel run was a great run, too, no matter what you think of it aesthetically. I think...
But again, that really came down to that he didn't give to others at the end when he needed to.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I also think the difference is Hogan was you can't envision – Hogan was either going to be the biggest supervillain or the biggest superhero. He was never going to be anything between because he wouldn't allow himself to be.
Mm-hmm.
Funk was perfectly fine being what he is, and there's a reason that Hulk Hogan is, you know, barely can walk and, you know, has had all these problems financially and with his family, and all this chaos has happened, and has sort of really whored himself out in the last 7 or 8 years. And Terry Funk, while he does occasionally still wrestle, by everything I know, is not in a position where he would die if he didn't have two or three bookings. You know,
exactly.
Like, not to say Hogan would either, but Hogan's clearly hurt himself in much the same way Flair has, not to the same degree, I don't think. But I definitely feel like they've both, you know, they both hurt themselves.
Well, the biggest thing that's hurt Hogan would be the Graziano stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But I mean,
and the follow-up.
Yeah. Being the, that would be, he is somewhat, at least largely, the author of his own misfortune with that, too. So.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, I mean, I think the Hogan Knows Best stuff was clearly bad for his family. And I think it was sort of him trying to ride the wave of his popular, once popular and fading star. And while Funk clearly enjoys being in the limelight, I mean, why would he do these matches? He doesn't strike you as somebody that has to be in the limelight.
And I think,
you know,
we can definitely put Beyond the Mat over Hogan Knows Best.
or The Ringer. You know, Terry Funk was in The Ringer, too, that Johnny Knoxville movie.
Was he?
Yes, he was a bodyguard.
I barely remember that.
I don't think he has a speaking role. I could be wrong, but he's a bodyguard in the movie, which I think is really funny because, like, at that point, Funk really didn't look that menacing or even that tough. Of all the guys to cast... And
he was a bit of a ringer himself, I guess.
Yeah, I just thought that was kind of odd. But and he's also not necessarily the kind of guy that people would immediately recognize and go, oh, that's your
no.
Guy. He's really tough. So it was very puzzling. But yeah, that's an interesting segue. So
yeah.
Anyway.
But Santo and Ricky Dozan, very important culturally. Didn't have the in-ring work that Funk does.
Yeah,
I think that would be what you could... For sure say. Although, I'm looking forward to watching some of the Ricky Dozan matches I managed to download last night. So.
Yeah, well, and also I think where Ricky Dozan and Santo were gods in their countries, Funk was a god in a country that wasn't his. I think that is very difficult to understate. I like how important that babyface was run and wasn't all Japan. No, it wasn't Ricky Dozan level.
It's really surreal.
It's very hard to explain if you don't understand the context of, you know, the traditional, you know, post-World War II Americans always being heels. And it's really shocking because it's almost like it went, you know, you have Ricky Dozan, then you've got Baba and Inoki, and then Funk is like the next guy. Like,
yeah.
Terry Funk, of all people, is the next guy, which on the surface seems absolutely insane. I mean, it seems insane that that's the guy that would sort of be the next guy, you know. I mean, so, yeah, definitely cannot be overstated. Anyway.
And Baba and Inoki, I would not put in-ring at Funk's level either.
No. Nowhere near.
I really hate Anoki, actually.
I think Anoki's actually not very good in the ring. I've had this argument before, but you know, there was a period in time where you could have convinced me that Anoki was a good wrestler. But he's got so much bad to go along with the good. You know, like, yes, he has good performances, but there's some absolutely torturous. I actually think I would rate Anoki below Hogan. with Hogan, you sort of know what you're getting. And he's capable of playing off the fans. And it seems like with Hogan, you never really – you're not going to be annoyed or disappointed by anything he does because he's got a shtick and you know it's coming. With Anoki, you really don't know which guy's going to show up. You know, it could be – you know, I mean, I've seen some terrible Anoki performances over the years. Unforgivably bad for a guy who obviously was a good athlete and could work a good match when he wanted to.
And both he and Hogan are very out of touch as far as understanding what wrestling is overall. They're very good as self-promoters, but not... I mean, yeah, Anoki's had great times as... the promoter of all New Japan, but you know, the promotion also suffered for his over pushing of himself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe not business wise, but aesthetically at least.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it hurt. I think it's, you know, big picture, Anoki's done as much to hurt Japanese wrestling as he's done to help it, probably more to hurt it, frankly.
I actually look at Hogan the same way.
I think that's arguable. I mean, I think it's definitely possible. I mean, you know, at that point, you really would be getting into a protracted discussion about the value of the territories and, you know,
I think people got tired of Hogan in the 90s, early 90s, and that kind of was part of, it wasn't just his departure. I think it was pre-departure that WWF, that things went down. And then, no question, he killed WCW, even though he raised it up, too.
Yeah, I think that's a tough. I mean, that to me is a very tough subject because you could really argue that if Hogan doesn't come into WCW, they're dead. So the question is, do you give him points for keeping it alive and then killing it years later? Do you give him the big black X because he, you know, had a huge hand in its death? I think that's a tough call, one way or the other.
Okay, other points of comparison with Funk, as far as greatest of all time, Austin and Rock.
Rock's run is just too short. I mean, Rock is, I think, very underrated in the ring. Obviously extremely charismatic.
Rock is almost as good in the ring as he is as personality, I think.
Yeah, he's another one of those guys like Choshu and Fujiwara. You know, I mean, like, you can forgive... maybe the not perfect execution in certain things because his charisma is overflowing in his matches. And that is something that guys, not everybody has. You know, there are plenty of good ring technicians, including guys most famous for killing their family, who did not necessarily, could not really insert that level of, even though Benoit's gimmick was, you know, that he was, you know, brutal and vicious or whatever in the ring, and he was very driven or whatever, and turns out that's how he was in real life.
Yeah.
But I think with The Rock, like, it didn't come across, like, the matches didn't come across as important, even though that was self-evident, whereas with The Rock, he's clearly not as stiff or snug or whatever term you want to use, and his offense didn't always look that great. And, you know, he would oversell from often, I guess you could say. But his matches always felt so good. Like, they always felt important. And I don't think that is a extremely important aspect of wrestling that you cannot break down point by point. You cannot isolate that on a spectrum of selling or bumping or stooge. It's totally different and stands outside of that entire hyper-analytical way of looking at matches.
And he was great at elevating others.
Oh, very Funk-esque, I would argue.
Brock Lesnar, Hurricane, that episode of Raw, which I was at live and was probably the best one-night heel performance you could ever have.
Oh, sure. The Hollywood Rock stuff is great. I mean, that's the thing. With The Rock, you know, if he had even 15 years, I don't even think he would need to have the length of the run some of these other guys have had. If he even had 15 years of that level of stuff, say his stuff from 99, even though I don't think there was a lot of good in the ring stuff that year, but
I would back it up to 98, actually.
Yeah, you could. Well, you could. That's perfect. I have no problem with that. You could even go to 98, and then, you know, say through nonstop until present day, or maybe a couple years down the road. I could possibly be persuaded for him, but his career is just too short. Period. A career that short, I can't take seriously in the discussion. No matter how big a star he was, no matter how many tickets he sold, no matter how much merchandise he sold, I can't put him at that very, very top level because.
The next year could add to his case a lot.
It wouldn't hurt it.
Yep.
I mean, it's definitely not going to hurt it, and I think the WWE desperately needs the help. So they may. I'm sure they're going to be willing to ride that train as long as he's willing to go, because they are up shit creek. if you look at a lot of the figures that are coming out of that place right now, and it's pretty clear they don't know what the hell's going on. But that's,
they got to get Vince out of creative.
I think that's the least of the trouble. I mean, I think there's a lot. I think it's a very not to get too sidetracked, but I think it's very easy to lay the blame entirely at Vince's feet. I think it is a much more systemic problem, because now it's not just that Vince is in creative and that the company does what people, assume Vince wants. It's also that, you know, Vince, the whole image is shaped in Vince's, or the whole company face is shaped in Vince's image now. And it's going to take years to get away from that without a drastic overhaul.
Mm-hmm.
Because the assumption now is that you do things this way. And that's not the right way to do things.
No,
so,
You know who they could use is Terry Funk.
That's it wouldn't hurt, again.
Actually, I love the story from Funk's book where I guess it was around 93, 94 that Vince tried to bring him in as booker and actually brought him to New York to interview him for the possibility. And I guess he basically had a panic attack from being in Manhattan. And he just left and started running. And I don't know if it was JR or Pat Patterson or someone asked him where he was going and what to tell Vince. And he said, "Tell Vince my horse is sick." And then he got in a plane and went back to Texas. And then in 97, when he came in for the Royal Rumble, when he came into Vince's office, Vince looked up at him and said, "How's your horse?" Yeah, Austin. Austin would actually be a pretty good comparison with Funk as far as, like, just persona goes.
Yeah, I think Austin, you know, one of the very few guys that can compare to Hogan as a draw.
As far as biggest draw of all time, it is Hogan or Austin.
I mean, I think it's Hogan because of the overall broad sweeping impact and the fact that he had two totally isolated peaks as a draw. I think that's important. But Austin, you know, definitely a huge draw, very good in the ring. Some of the best matches in the history of the WWF, for sure. With the Bret matches.
And best program stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Great on the mic. It was definitely a true ace. I think what does, you know, what hurts Austin also is the relative brevity of his career compared to Funk. But I think another thing that hurts him is he was never as tight a wrestler in the ring. He never, despite his persona being that of a badass, he didn't.
He has a neck injury, and that kind of damaged his in ring.
I mean, there's absolutely a reason.
Still
for
great,
it.
But you know,
I don't think it translates quite as well into the ring, though, the character as Funk's did. And I think another thing that you kind of hold against Austin is the fact that, and we may disagree on this, but I think his pre-WWF work is wildly overrated. I mean, his WCW run, I think, is, you know, and I say overrated because of what people have sort of made it out to be in the past. I'm not so sure that it's that highly rated anymore. But for a long time, it was regarded as this really, really good run. And, I mean, frankly, I mean, he was the fifth best guy in the Dangerous Alliance. You know, I mean, like, that's not enough, because that was a really good group. But the point is, Austin was not anywhere near at the level that I think some people may assume he was during his WCW run.
I look at him as someone who was very good and getting better all the time.
I don't disagree with that. But, I mean, like, if you compare him to, say, somebody like a Jumbo or a Tenryu who had their pre-prime, I think if you look at the pre-prime of Jumbo and Tenryu, it's better than the pre-prime of Austin.
Yeah.
And I like, and by a pretty clear margin. It's not close particularly either. So I think that would hurt Austin. I think Austin's strength is almost entirely his WWF run. And it's big enough where you could consider him part of the debate, but I don't think it's big enough for him to be the winner.
Correct, yeah. Another contender is Luthez.
Very hard to say.
Longevity is on question. He's actually, Meltzer did an analysis of drawing power, and he's up there. Actually, he was possibly first or second. I think Lonjo's actually might have been one of the biggest. But, I mean, he's not just this boring technical guy like people think of him.
No, 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 no.
Brilliant as far as wrestling goes if you read Hooker.
A much more modern wrestler than Fez led on, by the way. I mean, if you, the evidence, the footage we have of Fez, I mean, he's stooging and doing all the stuff you would expect of a modern heel. This, the mythology that he sort of tries to get across at times, or has over the years, himself, of being, you know, this very straight-laced, wrestling was serious business when I, in my day. I mean, that's mostly bullshit.
Actually, when you read his book, he actually would be much more accurate to what we're saying as far as what his actual career was like.
Yeah, I think in Hooker, which I've not read, I think in Hooker, but I've read about it, and I need to read it. But
yeah, you have to. It's amazing.
I think in Hooker, the you know, and I'm not talking about a person Jerry Estrada threw off a parking garage, but I think the thing about it is he was, you know, I don't think he was 100% honest. Nobody is, but I think he probably was willing to give a little bit more on than when he got older in the years, even, and, you know, was posting on like the Wrestling Classics message board, and he had his disciples who were like basically trying to get over how wrestling was serious business in his day, and they wouldn't be doing X, Y, and Z, which is totally bogus garbage that nobody really believes.
I've been reading about stuff pre-Thez that would indicate that that's not true. So.
Oh, absolutely not. So, Thez is an interesting candidate, but I feel like it's honestly hard
for us to say without the video.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to say. We just don't have a big enough composite of his career. The other main guy, I would argue, from a similar time period is Ray Stevens, who's always been talked up by Bobby Heenan and Flair and these others as, you know, the greatest in-ring worker they ever saw.
Yeah.
It was clearly a draw in his time. Again, with Stevens, we just don't have any footage. And I think what kind of an indictment of Stevens, although I hate to use that term, but is that Stevens post-prime, now clearly way past post-prime in the AWA, we don't even really get a hint of him being as good as you would expect him to be. I mean,
it didn't hit as broad a range either, right? Like, you know, like Funk he didn't have the Funk babyface run in Japan.
No, definitely not. I mean, he doesn't have that total package, definitely.
And he doesn't have an ECW-type cult following. And, you know, he doesn't have the stuff that he can compare to Funk on is, you know, Funk was looked at as great in the 70s and the 80s as well. But,
yeah.
Who were we talking about? Oh, Thez. You know what, a knock I'll put on Thez is, and this is based on what he says as well, and it's also based on reputation, is that if he didn't view someone as a legitimate wrestler, he wouldn't put him over.
Yeah.
So if you want to add legitimate wrestling ability, that's something you would probably have over Funk.
Yeah.
But as far as performance and working goes, I'd say Funk would have it over him.
I would be shocked if Fez was a demonstrably better worker than Funk. I just think there's very few guys that have even been on that level you know, so I would be very shocked if he was demonstrably better, even if we did have the footage. So that's my thought on that. But yeah.
Anyone else you can think of that go? I don't put Andre, Undertaker, those guys into the argument for best.
No, there's really only two other guys. There are two guys I would want to mention real quick.
Edge. and Silo Sam.
Silo Sam is awesome. But, man, what did you see that battle royal? I would throw out, not that I'm going to vouch for either of you, said I'm going to quickly shoot them both down. But I think these are two guys that have sort of lately, like in the last 3 or 4 years, sort of picked up steam as guys in this discussion, so I think they're worth mentioning. And that's Eddie Guerrero and Stan Hansen.
Mm-hmm. How did I miss Stan Hansen? Yeah.
I mean, with Eddie, I think Eddie definitely has the versatility in terms of I would argue Eddie is right there with Funk, both in terms of versatility against opponents and versatility in settings and versatility of roles. He is right there with Funk. I think that is indisputable. I think Eddie was not as consistent a promo as Funk, but his best promos are right there with Funk's best promos. I think Eddie's best matches are right there with Funk's best matches. What I would say is I think Eddie had much more downtime than Funk, where he was clearly not that good. You know, whether it be because of the drugs or injuries, the reality is he just had periods where he was either inactive or just was not that good.
Less opportunity, too, at some time.
Yeah.
You know, like held down in WCW, although he was great there.
Yeah, and I mean, I think he's become a more beloved figure in death, which is, there's nothing wrong with that, because in a lot of ways, he's a guy who you got the feeling was just right about to become, if not the very top star, right next to that level.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was clearly a great wrestler, clearly a wrestler. I mean, the reaction to his win over Brock Lesnar, I think, is one of the great live crowd reactions of all time. You know, like an authentic happiness, not happiness that was being foisted upon people. they weren't happy because, you know, the promotion had pulled their heartstrings the right way. They were happy because a guy they wanted to win had won. And that's rare. That is not that common, I don't think, especially in modern wrestling where a lot of it is about shoving guys down people's throats. But I don't think because of that downtime and because I think of being less consistent as a total package, I can't rate him at Funk's level. Hansen, I think, is a very interesting case because Hansen, you know, has a 15-year period that is really, really great. And
that being 80 to 95? Or, no, probably 78 to 83, 93 probably.
Yeah, right in that – I would say 94. Yeah. I would say like 79 to 94, you know.
Yeah.
And he's got that run where he's really great. I mean, I think you could say he's Inoki's best opponent and Baba's best opponent. I think you could say – that he was definitely the, you know, the best gaijin wrestler in the history of all Japan, with the possible exception of Terry Funk. I mean, those are the two guys right there. He was, you know, I think the big knock against Hansen, and this isn't even necessarily a knock per se, is I would say Hansen's best matches, best maybe better than Funk's. He may have even had more great, like, all-encompassing great matches than Funk. But, you know, Funk doesn't really have a period like Hansen had when he came to WCW and just didn't really do anything of note. You know, Funk doesn't. And another thing is Hansen.
I think the Desperados would disagree with you, my friend. I think they're still looking for him.
But the...
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Hansen, you know, I think another thing, you know, and that was during basically Hansen's prime. It's not like this was, you know, Funk showing up.
Washed up.
Chainsaw Charlie, although even that got over him.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, it got over. I mean, it did well. That's kind of the funny thing is it's laughable and great simultaneously. But Hansen has that. And Hansen also, I think, he was definitely a one-trick pony in the ring. I mean, it so happened that his trick was really great, you know, but he is not a versatile wrestler. I mean, he's a better sort of groundy, like simplistic mat worker than maybe people would give him credit for, you know, and he's more multidimensional, I think, maybe than people would give him credit for. But ultimately, he had one style, and he was, and
okay,
it was not,
one style,
it was,
yeah.
Yeah, it was not adaptative. He was not going to do rolling cradle stunts.
I thought you were saying one move.
No. But, I mean, he wasn't going to do rolling cradle spots with Dos Caras, right? I mean, which Terry Funk would do. You know, he wasn't going to do, he wasn't going to throw a moonsault into his repertoire at the age of 50, which was probably smart because God knows what would happen if Stan Hansen had moonsaulted somebody. But, you know, he just wasn't, I mean, he had his thing and he was really great at it, but I don't think he had the versatility Funk had.
No. Well, okay. Hansen in Japan does get it over Funk, just in terms of longevity even. And
yeah.
Just the stuff he did in the 90s is enough. I don't think the distance between Funk and Hansen in Japan is as big as the distance between Hansen and Funk in America, though.
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally 100% agree with that. And Hansen has some stuff in the United States that was really good. His AWA stuff, he has some really good stuff that I think people don't even know about.
Unquestionably some of his MSG stuff is run against Bruno and even against Backlund.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's at least one Backlund match from MSG I like a lot. But I think that it is very, very small.
Sorry, I should say WWF run rather than MSG, because I'm sure they did house shows, did the loop pretty well, too. Anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, but I would say he had very... he's not as big a player in the States. And the drop off is pretty dramatic. That was by his own choosing, good for him, but Funk as the trailblazer overall I think is a bigger picture candidate. I think that's about it. I mean I can't think of anybody else. I mean I think Rey Mysterio is an emerging figure, but I think the problem with Rey is while he's tremendous in the ring, and I would rate him right up there with anybody in the ring. And while I think he's not nearly as bad on the mic as some people say he is,
he's great on the mic. He sounds like a little kid, and he has little kids that like him. So
yeah, I think the thing is though, he's not a transformative mic worker. You know,
no,
he's not a
no.
guy. You're never going to remember Rey Mysterio promo ever. It's just not going to happen. I guess I'm
thinking of that commercial right now with him with the light ray gun. I get
that's
a kick
the promo you think of. That's
that,
awesome.
Yeah.
The promo you think of is him putting over toys.
Yes.
but no, I think that.
I'm sorry.
That
I would love to see Terry Funk in that commercial too.
Oh God. Yeah.
Anyways, so yeah, but he doesn't have the transformative promos that Funk does.
I think that alone doesn't really put. I mean, he doesn't. Rey has great matches. Rey's kind of a victim of the era he's in. I feel like, on the one hand, he may not have gotten the opportunities in a different era because of his size. On the other hand, I feel like because of the way the booking is done, we maybe don't know how big of a star and figure he could have been. But he would
always be a big star as Rey Mysterio, whereas when you try to nail down Terry Funk, there's so many different aspects, and that's where the versatility comes in.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree with that.
Yeah, I think we're going to be done here soon. So, I mean, to wrap up, I think obviously probably the biggest candidate would be Flair in comparison to him. And I would honestly go with Funk, not just because it's the subject of the show, but I think I've pretty much convinced myself in recent times that I do prefer Funk over Flair, and I would probably say he's probably I will put him as the best of all time.
Yeah, I mean he's definitely my greatest of all time pick for all the reasons we've discussed and probably others we didn't even get to, because he did have such a lengthy career with so many good matches and so many good elements to it overall. I think another kind of a final comment touch up. I think Flair is definitely the most obvious candidate in terms of people who've been explored and we've watched everything and we know everything about him. I think the other really three guys that I think I could maybe be convinced in the future, depending on if more evidence emerges, you know, is Jerry Lawler. I think is kind of, I'm on the fence. I don't quite think he has the intangibles.
Like Rey Mysterio, Jerry Lawler has pretty much always been Jerry Lawler, and that is a great thing.
but not the versatility that Funk has.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely got the versatility in terms of babyface and heel and the ability to do both.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
But I don't know that he has the versatility in the broader picture in terms of how he works.
Japan, America,
ECW, right,
yeah. NWA.
But the two candidates I would throw out would be Negro Cassius and Tenryu. I think if you know, we get to a point where 90s Tenryu is explored more, and Cassius is somebody that more people watch, and we really dig in, and we're able to uncover enough footage. I think those are the two guys besides Flair that I think would have the best case, because they do have that longevity and they do have that record of being good when they were older, on top of the peak run and being iconic figures. So, you know, having said that, definitely Terry Funk for me. No questions asked. There are guys that, you know, maybe one day I will be able to be convinced if I watch enough or hear enough or see enough.
Yeah, argument. I mean, a name that I'm just realizing we didn't mention would be Gene Kaniski or someone like that. All time, but, you know, I mean, it's hard to argue him over Funk.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a lot of guys like that. There's going to be a lot of those peripheral, I'd say peripheral, but they're really not. I mean, they were huge stars in their time. But guys like that, you could sort of throw into the discussion, but they just don't feel like they're on Funk's level.
Yeah, even Foley.
Yeah, they just don't feel like they're on Funk's level, period. So,
Our next podcast planned for quite possibly this Saturday is with Kurt Brown, where we're going to talk about the greatest gimmicks of all time. Not greatest as far as success-wise, greatest as far as, you know, innovative, just greatest as far as they make you giggle.
Yeah, I think there will be a lot of there was not as much laughy stuff on this show. I think that show, the show on Saturday, is going to be a lot of me making inappropriate remarks, Dave trying to reel me in, and then Kurt making inappropriate remarks.
And me making some as well. I try to be funny.
But no, I mean, this
is Kurt Brown who we're talking about. This man is like the Weird Al Yankovic of professional wrestling fans.
That should definitely come on Saturday.
I'm pretty happy with this show. I think the points can be argued, but I pretty much convinced myself, and I know you were already convinced anyways. And you know what? I welcome any comments from any people that are listening. We got about 75 people listening to the last show, which is probably more people than I've seen at some indie shows, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, that's not bad.
Yeah, so I welcome any comments from people. You know, I ask that you be polite. I welcome the argument and the discussion that can come out of this. So thanks for doing the show, Dylan. And
Of course.
Be in touch with you through the week and talk to you on Saturday for sure.
As always, if you'll have me again, we'll do plenty more.
Let's say it's a go.
All right. Adios, Mr. Canada.
Take care, bud.